Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of July. The authors, at least we have one of them now, we'll get the other one sometime during this hour, of Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes, Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, will be our guest this hour. The authors majored in philosophy at Harvard back in the 1960s, and they have been friends ever since. Tom worked with street gangs in Chicago and has dropped in and out of various divinity schools. Dan wrote jokes for comedians, designed stunts for Candid Camera, and also writes thrillers. And they say that philosophy and jokes proceed from the same impulse. They both confound our sense of the way things are, slip our worlds upside down, and ferret out hidden, often uncomfortable truths about life. There are chapters on metaphysics, logic, epistemology, ethics, the philosophy of religion, existentialism, the philosophy of language, social and political philosophy, relativity, and meta-philosophy, and more. And we'll be talking about all of that and hearing some jokes that relate to existence this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. We're having a hard time reaching Daniel Klein, but Thomas is with us now, so we will proceed with Thomas. Do you like to be called Thomas or Tom?
Just Thomas. Fine, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah. So studying philosophy at Harvard, that's a worthy pursuit. Hard to get a job afterward, though, right?
Very hard, yeah. We're glad we now have a successful book, because even though our parents are now all deceased, we'd love to be able to wake them up and say, see, we told you so.
It was going to pay off sooner or later, yeah. And it actually, the book has become incredibly successful. I don't know if you thought it was going to, but it's there's something going on that people are buying it. They're really interested in this.
It totally shocked us.
What does it mean?
I don't know. I have no clue. Danny thinks it means that people are sort of tired of being lied to and are looking for, hidden meanings. Or I don't know if that's it, or I don't know what it is, but it's fun, whatever it is.
I'm sure it is. Tell me about this idea that philosophy and jokes. Well, before we do that, let's get Daniel on the air now, too. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, fine. How are you?
Good. I had something wrong with my phone, and they say there are no accidents.
Yeah, just the day you got to have the phone work. The phone doesn't work.
I know.
Yeah.
They're trying to tell me something.
I guess. What are they trying to tell you?
They're trying to tell me to speak up.
And so you are. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how
Hi,
are you?
Hi, good.
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's fine. It's no problem. Tom carried your weight.
Yeah, as he has done throughout this project,
throughout our lives, actually.
Oh, you guys are fun. You need to go on the road with your comedy routine, Doug,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, if they could provide us with wheelchairs, we're willing.
Oh, yeah, do it before they're necessary. What about this idea that philosophy and jokes proceed from the same impulse? What is that impulse?
Go ahead, Danny.
Well, you know, they both have kind of a surprise element to them that you know, sometimes it's very difficult, particularly for me, because I'm the dumber of the two of us, to get a philosophical concept. Like, let's say the concept of you can't prove there are other minds because you only are inside your own mind.
Hmm.
And yet we go through our daily lives, you know, interacting with other people, reading other people's ideas and stuff. But, you know, the solipsistic argument is that, all you really have is your own mind, your own consciousness. Well, I couldn't get that. And then I got it. I saw it. And I had this kind of aha experience.
Mm.
And that's the same thing that happens with a good joke. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's some jokes that, you know, where it takes you a couple seconds and then you go, I got it.
Mm-hmm.
And
when you laugh,
similar feeling.
Mm-hmm.
When you laugh, part of your delight is with yourself. You know, I got it.
Right.
Yes. And it's getting your mind outside of its usual ways of thinking, those hardwired pathways, and getting outside the your usual framework, your usual universe of thought.
Right.
And a good joke will do that.
Yeah.
And often on the same subjects that philosophy do, because, you know, jokes are usually based on those things that cause us anxiety and wonder, and that's philosophy is all about, dealing, a lot of it, like existential philosophy, is about dealing with the anxiety of being a finite person in an infinite world, and the fact that we're going to die. And joke is a relief.
Right.
And there are a lot of great death jokes. Can we give you a couple of examples?
Go right ahead.
Okay. Well, first of all, to set the stage, the existentialists, particularly Heidegger, thought that being as a person was being toward death. He called it being toward death. It probably sounds better in German. But in any case, what he meant was that in order to live really deeply and really meaningfully, we should be in touch with our own death.
Hmm.
You know, we shouldn't just get caught up in the everyday. We should live sort of in the shadow of the volcano. And that way we would live more richly and more fully. So there are a lot of jokes about the denial of death, the tendency we all have to sort of put it out of our minds. So these three friends are killed in an automobile accident. And they're standing up by the pearly gates, chatting away. And one of them says, you know, I really would like to know what people are saying about me at my wake. What I would hope they were saying is that I was a wonderful father and family man and a good provider for my children. And the other guy says, yeah, you know, what I'd like to hear somebody say is that I was a terrific doctor and I really cared a lot about my patients. And the third guy says, what I'd like to hear somebody say is, look, he's moving.
Can I tell my favorite?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
It's a kind of a touching story because Gilda Radner, when she was given, her sentence, as it were, by her doctor that she wasn't going to live very long, went before a live audience and told this joke. And the joke is, this woman is given a diagnosis by her doctor that she's not going to live through to the next day. And when her husband comes home, she tells him and she says, honey, it's my last day. Let's make love. And he says, well, you know, sometimes you're in the mood, sometimes you're not in the mood. You can't just summon up these things. And she says, honey, please, I'm asking you. It's my dying wish. And he says, yeah, it's easy for you. You don't have to get up in the morning.
Oh, for God's sake. Oh, my.
That would be kind of a cruel joke if it weren't for the fact that Gilda Radner told it.
Exactly. You
know?
What a
courageous act.
Yeah. What a very courageous act. Oh, those are wonderful.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Out of that, the existential movement came a modern, I think it was American, although the woman sounds German. Kubler-Ross had this hospice movement.
Sure.
And making your final days meaningful. And being aware, I mean, the thing that Tom mentioned before about being, you know, you aren't really, the way I interpret Husserl is that you aren't really living until you think about death all the time. And so a guy goes into a restaurant, and he goes to the chef, and he says, how do you prepare your chicken? And the chef says, oh, we just tell them they're going to die.
Oh. So let's talk, what is the meaning of all of it? I mean, we're going to die. We're here for such an incredibly short period of time. We do these talk shows on history, on the future, on what's happening all over the world. What does it all mean? Because we're all going to be gone.
Yeah. Right, there are a lot of meaning of life jokes that ask exactly that question.
Right.
A lot of meaning of life philosophy and a lot of meaning of life jokes that illustrate it. You know, like the guy who goes to India searching for the meaning of it all, and he asks for the wisest guru in all of India, and he's directed to go to the top of this Himalayan mountain peak where this guru apparently lives in a cave by himself. And so he spends weeks trekking up this mountain, climbing over the rocks, and he's bruised and he's scratched, and he finally, after days and days, he makes it to the top of the mountain, and sure enough, there's the guru sitting serenely outside his cave. And the man approaches him and kneels before him and says, oh, great guru, tell me the meaning of it all. And the guru says, the meaning of life, my son, is a teacup. The guy says, a teacup? I spent weeks climbing up here to see you, and you tell me the meaning of life is a teacup? And the guru says, so it's not a teacup.
That's kind of our position so far.
That's about as far as we've gotten. Yes. We're still searching.
We're a little bit like Groucho Marx, who said, "These are my principles. If you don't like them, I have others."
Yeah, right. I remember that one. That's yeah. good. Take on what philosophers have said in jokes related to this this notion of infinity.
Well. I can give you, infinity is related to eternity, of course, which is an infinite amount of time. And this one ties in with the business that you just mentioned in the, about, you know, what are we to do with our finite life period? And how do you compare that to an infinity of time, to eternity? And there's this woman. God, I must be in a terribly deaf-minded mood this morning. But there's this woman, and whose doctor has just told her that she has 6 months to live. And she asks him if there's anything she can do about it. And he says, "Well, yes, you could marry a tax accountant."
Oh, no.
And she said, "Marry a tax accountant? Well, how would that affect my disease?" And he says, "Well, it won't affect your disease, but it will make 6 months feel like an infinity, an eternity."
Yeah.
Oh, that's a sad one.
It is a sad one, but
especially
it is true.
If you're a tax accountant.
Yeah. If you really love what you're doing, your life goes way too fast, don't you think?
Yes, that's why it's better to be bored.
Right.
Yes, it slows things down. Right. Have a lousy life.
I agree with you. Yeah, me too. So where do you get all these? Well, first of all, let's talk about the organization of the book. Is it organized on the great philosophical questions, or did you just find all the great jokes and then you tried to fit them into philosophical areas?
Well, actually, it's organized by the sort of branches of philosophy, you know, like logic, the ones that you detailed at the beginning, logic, epistemology, which is theories of knowledge, ethics, of course, you know, all of the big subject matter of philosophy.
In fact, our modus operandi, though, was often to start with a joke and see where it fitted into this matrix of all the different disciplines of philosophy.
Right.
Many of which were laid down, you know, in the Socratic era.
Right.
In the Golden Age of Greece.
And the jokes, are the jokes modern jokes, or are we talking about jokes that have been around for thousands of years?
Well, a lot of them. I'm the Jewish half of this duo, and a lot of them are... I don't know how old they are, but they go back to Eastern Europe, those Eastern Europe shtetl jokes, a lot of the absurdist jokes, and a lot of the logic jokes come from those, you know, like the one about the rabbis holding court, and somebody stands up and he says, "Listen, Shmuel takes his sheep across my land to get to the pond, and he's ruining my crops, all these sheep walking all over my crops. He shouldn't be allowed to do that." And the rabbi says, "You're right." And then Shmuel stands up and he says, "Listen, for centuries, sheep have had the right of way to the pond. If they couldn't, they'd die. So he has to honor that." And the rabbi says, "You're right." And somebody in the back says, "But Rabbi, they both can't be right." And the rabbi says, "You're right."
And then there's some very modern, up-to-date jokes, too, like the joke about the four psychiatrists who go to a conference on professional ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And as they're walking out, one of them says, "You know, we spend all day long listening to the anxieties and problems and depressions of our patients, but we don't really ever have any chance to share our stuff with other people. So how about if we form a little group of our own and sort of, you know, confess our own, you know, unconscious wishes, our own shadow side to each other?" And the other three guys say, "Well, that's terrific. Why don't you start?" So he says, "Okay." He says, "You know, I've never shared this with anybody before, but I'd like to confess that I always try to steal money from my patients. I overcharge them, and I try to take them for as much money as I possibly can." And the second guy says, "Well, as long as we're confessing our deepest, darkest secrets," he said, "I have to confess that I sell drugs to my patients." And he said, "I often get them to sell them for me."
Ooh.
Yeah. And the third one says, "Oh, boy, we're really letting it all hang out here." He said, "I have to confess that I try to seduce as many of my female patients as possible. And so far, I've got quite a significant track record." The fourth guy says, "My secret is that no matter how hard I try, I can't seem to keep a secret."
But, well, by the way, these are great.
that's from the realm of bioethics, which is a modern, very practical part of the philosophy of ethics, of evaluation, what's good and what's bad. It's very practical because in earlier philosophical thought, it was all finding principles of what's right and wrong, and it had very little to do with, you know, it's good to eat spinach and bad to eat liver. I don't know. Something like that. Tastes bad.
You asked the question, and it seems so perfect from the jokes you've been giving us. A whole bunch of jokes just happen to occupy the identical conceptual territory as these disciplines that we mentioned before. Is this just pure chance, or is there an intelligent designer after all? Yeah.
Yes. I think there might be an intelligent designer in some sense. You know, sometimes I look at a flower and I say, boy, that, you know, that was designed very well, and but that doesn't mean that there's some clockmaker up, you know, I mean, you know, some designer in the sky who's making it happen. It means that evolution evolved something that designed things rather pleasantly.
Mm-hmm. And so intricately, isn't it? Doesn't every day that thought strikes me? This, look at this world. It's just, there's so much in it. It's so complex, and so many of the designs are so interesting. It's just, it's quite a place.
Yeah, and I think that's worthy of awe. I'm struck by awe by it, and maybe that's a religious experience. Mm. But to jump from that religious experience to the idea that there's an intelligent designer is nonsense. Tom, maybe you have a better idea of how to explain how Hume approached that. David Hume.
Right. Well, Hume was very skeptical of that. He said, what you're doing is you're making an analogy. You're saying if you came across a clock, you would conclude that there was a clockmaker. So you've come across a universe, so you assume there's a universe maker. But he said, why is that the analogy? You know, why not say the universe is like a kangaroo because all the parts are organically connected, the whole thing works as a system, et cetera, et cetera. And if you use that analogy, you'd come to a very different conclusion about the origin of the universe. You'd say that the universe was born after a second universe and a third universe had sex with each other.
You had to be there. It was called the Big Bang. No, I didn't say that.
That's where we get that expression.
Right. Never thought of it that way. We're going to welcome phone calls for our guests. The book is Plato and a Platypus. Walk into a bar, understanding philosophy through jokes. Our guests are Thomas Cathcart, Daniel Klein. They majored in philosophy at Harvard in the 1960s and finally found a way to use all of that knowledge these many years later in a book that's really just taken off. Tom has worked with street gangs in Chicago. He's been in divinity schools. Dan has written for comedians and continues to write thrillers. So the book looks at chapters on metaphysics, as I said, in ethics, philosophy of religion, existentialism, philosophy of language, and then these jokes that are that arise out of all of those areas. So it's a very unique book and very funny. Welcome to your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 227-2050, 414-227-2050. Jokes and philosophical concepts made out of the same stuff, the premise of this. They tease the mind in similar ways, and that's because philosophy and jokes proceed from the same impulse to confound our sense of the way things are, to flip our worlds upside down, and to ferret out hidden, often uncomfortable truths about life. So call us, okay? I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thomas Cathcart, Daniel Klein, our guests, their book is Plato and a Platypus, Walk into a Bar. And we're welcoming phone calls for them. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Before we go to phone calls, gentlemen, tell me about the connection between the two of you. Don't you think it's interesting that you've stayed friends all of these years, and philosophy and jokes have been the basis, I'm sure, of a lot of that friendship? We don't have many friends for that long a period of time. So, tell me your story. How did that happen?
It's pretty amazing. We met on the first day of our freshman year in college. And we've lived.
We both had hair then. We've watched each other lose our hair over these 50 years.
Wow.
We've always lived in different places. Well, one exception, we lived together in the town of Woodstock, New York for a while. Mm. But other than that, we've always lived in different places. But we've always made it a point to get together a couple times a year. In the early days, before email, we used to write letters to each other. And now with email, it's a lot easier to keep in contact on a daily basis.
Mm.
And as I say, we've continued the friendship. And we've worked at it, and it's worked for us.
Yeah, it's a blessing. It really is to have somebody you can count on.
That is a blessing. So do you send jokes to each other, or do you get into heavy philosophical discussions?
Both. A little bit of both.
Yeah, we do a lot of both. And, you know, because we've known each other so long, in some ways we've formed each other's sensibilities. And, and so we have almost some philosophical shorthand and some joke shorthand that really bothers our wives.
So maybe the friendship has proven that that you can prove that there are other minds.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, or else we're the same person.
Or else we're both terribly deluded.
Yes. The fact of the matter, we've never been photographed together, so I don't know. Well, we can't actually get into the same photograph because Tom is a foot taller than I am.
Ah. Let's go to Ruth from Richland Center. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I just wanted to relate a story that relates to your book. My granddaughter is a fourth-year student in philosophy at UMadison. She has a job down in North Carolina in Salem right at the moment, and she's been telling me on her email and her calls about how it's going. She's teaching a philosophy course to high school, and they've done this for a good number of years down in North Carolina. They have a governor's program on teaching courses like this in their schools in the summertime. It's a summer program. So she calls me up, and how nice it's down there, but there's a cultural gap that's a problem. But the next thing, she said, oh, they're so rowdy today. And then my friend said, did you know about this book? Plato and Platypus Go Into a Bar. I said, no, I never heard of it. So she said, well, she'd just gotten it. And I called the bookstore. They had it. I sent it to my granddaughter. And it's a hit down there. They're having such a great time with it. Their other teachers are so envious because she's got this little book, and they're playing around with it, and it's made their day.
That was our hope, that would happen, that the schools would pick it up and use it as a supplementary text.
Yeah.
Great.
That makes me happy on two accounts. The other account is both my parents are from Milwaukee.
Oh, you're kidding me.
And this caller sounds like my mother, who's long gone.
Oh.
I hadn't heard, that particular. I remember when they would only take radio announcers from that area because it was the universal accent of America. Do you remember that?
Right. Yeah, sure.
And then we moved east. I mean, I was born in the east, but to hear her voice gave me a little goosebumps.
And to know how the book is being used by her daughter, it's a wonderful story.
Oh, I love that. That's one of our dreams, isn't it, Tom?
You betcha.
Yeah, especially young people. You know, when I was a teenager, I was wondering about these big questions. My parents used to say, God, the little philosopher out there, instead of doing the lawn, he's thinking about if there's a God. It worked for me.
Yeah. Well, it makes you think, except that everybody's taking all these tests and studying for the test now, that these are obvious classes. Philosophy ought to be a class for high school kids. This is what you're thinking about when you're in high school.
Exactly. Absolutely. Right.
I agree. I couldn't agree more.
So why don't we do it?
Well, maybe they will. Maybe even will be some help in that regard.
Yeah,
I think we're on a bad track right now in terms of, the No Child Left Behind notion, which is great in itself. We shouldn't be leaving any children behind. But the idea that we can standardize all that knowledge and then ask kids to spit it out, well, philosophy doesn't lend itself to standardization.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and how do you standardize wonder?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, or what's it all about?
Yes.
What are we doing here?
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Bob from Greenwood. Hello, Bob.
Good morning, guys. I have an original thought that I don't know if your guests will believe it's all that funny, but it says in the Bible that the laborer is worthy of his hire. So does that mean that food for thought is adequate payment for a philosopher?
I don't know if it's adequate, but it's about all there is.
Yes. I say it depends on who the chef is.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks. Thanks so much for the call. Bob from Darlington. Hi.
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 I think I know why the book is so successful.
Why?
And I haven't read it yet, but it sounds like a wonderful book. I think because it contains all aspects of life and living.
Hmm.
You know, it contains ethics and social, political science, religion, everything.
Hmm.
And I think it's a total package, and I think people really enjoy that.
Hmm.
Yes.
And that's a great thought. I hope that's right.
That's great.
And do you have any other political science jokes?
Well, actually, we do.
Yes, our next book, which is coming out next year, is Using Philosophy and Jokes to Analyze Political Talk.
Ah, good.
Because there are a lot of fallacies that we routinely hear from political candidates and government officials and pundits and stuff like that.
Right.
They're just making out-and-out mistakes in logic. And so we put our minds to that in our next book, which is going to be called Aristotle and an Aardvark Go to Washington.
Sounds great.
I don't know where we came up with that.
I don't
that
either. Yeah, that's great.
You know what? May I interject?
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons why people are interested in philosophy in general, I mean, not just our book, like that the book by Professor Frankfurt of Princeton, On Baloney, it was called. and these the so-called new atheist books, you know, like this one by Christopher Hitchens and the one by Sam
yeah.
Harris called The End of Faith, which was a fabulous book, is that people are a little skeptical. And part of the reason that people, I think, this is my theory, that people are skeptical is because we're being lied to a lot.
Mm.
And whereas we used to trust authorities much more easily than we do now, there is a logical fallacy, what they call an informal fallacy, called what is it called, advercundium? Tom, how do you pronounce that?
Mm-hmm. The argumentum advercundium.
Yes, which means the argument from authority, and that works in some regards. Like you know, if you want to know something about quantum physics, it's nice to find a professor at MIT. You know, that's a good authority.
Nice.
But a baseball player who comes out and says you should vote for candidate X is not necessarily a good authority. And there's a great joke that goes with that one about this guy is walking down the street and he sees another guy and he says, "Al, amazing, I'd heard you died." And Al says, "Well, as you can see, I'm very much alive." And the other guy says, no, the guy who told me you had died was a much better authority than you are.
Oh, my.
the caller asked about social and political philosophy, and actually that is one of the chapters in the book. And one of the towering figures, of course, in social and political philosophy was Machiavelli.
Mm.
And so there's some great jokes about Machiavellian behavior. You know, behavior where you try to appear upright, but you sneak a little shiv in at the same time. So there's a great story about a woman who sues a man for defamation of character. And she charges that he called her a pig. So they go to trial, and the man's found guilty, and he's ordered to pay damages. And then after the trial, he says to the judge, he says, does this mean that I can no longer call Ms. Harding a pig? And the judge says, absolutely right. That's correct. The man says, well, does it mean that I can't call a pig Ms. Harding? And the judge says, well, no, you're free to call a pig Ms. Harding. There's no crime in that. So the man looks at Ms. Harding in the eye and says, good afternoon, Ms. Harding.
Great joke. Great joke.
It's a great joke. It's a great joke. Let's go next to, we have some lines open. They've been crowded. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 227-2050. Jane from Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, Kathleen, and good morning to your guests. Kathleen, I just want to say real quickly, I've been a fan of yours for years. You do such a wonderful job. You really do.
Thanks,
and
Jean.
I have great respect for you.
Thanks.
But back to their book, my father was a mortician, and unfortunately he's been gone for a long time, but he would have loved this book.
Mm.
Just because I think growing up in that way, we have a slightly quirky way of looking at life and certainly death. And all of my brothers and sisters and I would say, are a little unusual in the way that we look at those things.
I imagine. So you never thought it was creepy. I mean, young children sometimes think of death and dying as kind of creepy.
Well, we lived upstairs from the funeral home, so as a very small child, yeah, it was definitely creepy. And I asked my father once about the dead people in the basement because I was worried about that, and he kind of laughed and he said, "Jane, when I'm done with them, they're really dead."
If they weren't when they came in, they are when they go out.
Now, nobody's going anywhere. So I can't wait to pick up the book, and thank you very much.
You know, there's a great paradox about emotion.
About what?
About a mortician.
Yeah.
And that is, there is a town in which there is a mortician who buries all those people who do not bury themselves. Does the mortician bury himself?
Oh.
Ooh.
Does that one
work, Tom? He doesn't, but if he doesn't, he does.
Yeah.
Whoa, what a paradox.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, it's interesting, her story. We could do an interview with her, because when you talk about living with death in mind all the time, certainly if your parents are in that kind of occupation, there's something going on in your mind with all of this every day growing up in some very substantial way, don't you think?
There must be.
I would think so. But, you know, in many ways, they may be more adjusted to it than the rest of us are.
Right.
I realized when my father passed away, and I requested to see him. I was with my brother at a mortuary, and I requested to see him. And he's been. And the guy said, "No, you don't want to see him." And I said, "I have never seen. I need it for closure. As why I need it. I need to see that he's really dead."
Mm-hmm.
But on the other part that was playing in my mind is, I had gotten to the age of 40 something, and I had never seen a dead human being.
Oh,
in
my goodness!
Life.
Really?
No, I had never seen one.
Oh, my.
And that's a very, you know, I mean, and whereas, like, I've known people who've grown up in farms, and they've seen dead animals, they've seen births, they've seen animals copulating. They're much more in touch with the real stuff of life than I ever was growing up in suburbs.
So did it make it harder for you, Daniel?
After I saw my father?
Yes.
Well, of course, I broke down. And,
right.
You know, I mean, quite frankly, the first thought that came to my mind, he was in a refrigerator, is that he looked like roadkill. You know? And he really looked dead.
Mm.
And this was the man who, you know, had been so important, obviously, to me. And to see him, it was, I was going to say sobering, but that's too small a word for it. But I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, I was about to ask you that. Would you?
I am glad I did it. I don't know whether my brother would say the same thing, because he was shocked. He was made dumb. I just broke down in tears, but he was made numb by it, the experience.
Yeah.
The caller probably knows all of the stories about death that there are, including this one. A painter goes into a gallery where his paintings are hanging, and he says to the gallery owner, he said, "How am I doing?" And the gallery owner says, "Well, I have some good news and some bad news." And the painter says, "Well, give me the good news first." He says, "Well, this morning," he said, "a man walked into the store and asked me if I thought you were the kind of painter whose paintings would be worth more after you were dead. And I said, I thought you were. So he bought all of your paintings in the store." And the painter says, "Well, that's fabulous. What's the bad news?"
Oh.
The gallery owner says, "He was your doctor."
Oh, you see that one coming.
You saw it coming.
Oh, that's funny. All right, let's take more phone calls for our guests. They are the author of, and I should tell you that the book has really taken off. It's on the New York Times bestseller nonfiction list. Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein, who've been friends since they were philosophy majors at Harvard back in the 1960s, they've been friends all these years. Isn't that good? It's good to have friends that long a period of time. So they sort of blend together. They're on the email together. They're they know a lot about each other. And the book is terrific. So we're talking about philosophy, and we're talking about jokes, and looking at how truth can be found through jokes and through philosophy. Or we can at least ask the question, what is it? What's truth? Let's go to Tom from Verona next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I mean this with the greatest compliment. You guys remind me of Bob and Ray.
Oh, that is a compliment.
That's a high compliment. Oh, thank you.
That's the best we've gotten. Those guys were my favorites.
The pacing, the tone of voice, the brilliant deadpan deliveries, Wally Baloo and all those characters.
I mean, it just
brings back memories.
They were the greatest.
Yeah, you should hear me do my Wittgenstein imitation. It's great.
Thanks for the call. Well, maybe, guys, that's where you go next with this, is you give us, you know, these audio jokes, do them on tape or something like that. That needs to be revived.
Oh, maybe.
Be
you
fun?
Know, narrative jokes have gone out of favor when you look at the Comedy Channel. They don't do jokes anymore, I think, because people don't have or maybe younger people don't have the same attention span that we do. I used to love jokes that went on and on forever.
You know, we did. We do so many shows on the Middle East and Iraq and terrorism, and you get down. I got to tell you, you get real down day after day and year after year. So a year ago, I don't know why, but we just decided to do jokes. So in summer, spring, winter, and fall, we do a joke show for an entire 2 hours. And the last one was mostly Bob and Ray, and we had Bob on the air. Bob is living in New York. Bob is still living. He's about 85, living in New York.
Boy, that's great.
Wonderful guy. Just one, and didn't realize how he had touched so many people's lives. You know, these people are calling and saying, I loved you. Your work is brilliant. You were brilliant. Just a very unassuming guy who still types on, not an electric typewriter, but a manual typewriter, and sent us a thank you note, you know, for being on the air. I'm thinking, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Oh, God, that is wonderful.
Yeah, he's still quite a guy.
You know, there's I'm just dying to tell a particular joke.
Sure.
Well, it has to, and it does have a deep philosophical basis. So, you know, somebody was asking you, what is truth? And you know, of course, that relates to, is there a God? And the tension between what reason tells us and what empirical experience tells us, and between the urge to faith, has always been in philosophy because it's really built into us. And so there's one of my favorite jokes that really nails that particular issue is there's this old guy, he's walking in the woods, and then he suddenly trips and falls down this well. And he's dropping, falling, hundreds of yards. He reaches out and he grabs onto this little spindly root and he's hanging on for dear life. And he looks up and all he sees is this circle of light at the top of the well. And he says, is there anybody up there? Is there anybody up there? And all of a sudden there's a great clap of thunder and a beam of light shines down on him through the hole. And a big voice says, I am the Lord your God. Have faith in me, and I will save you. Let go of the root. And the guy looks up, and he says, is there anybody else up there?
Oh, that's wonderful. Let's take more phone calls, and we'll do it in a moment. Rhonda brought in a letter we got from Bob Elliott, which I will share because some of you heard that show, too. Dear Kathleen, I thoroughly enjoyed the walk down memory lane on your program yesterday morning. Afterwards, I realized I hadn't wished you Merry Christmas. I apologize for the oversight and hope you had a good one and you'll have a happy new year. Thanks for having me on and best wishes to your producer, Rhonda. And then on the bottom, you write, celebrating a half century on this Olympia Standard manual keyboard. We've put that one on our bulletin board and we'll always remember him. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guests this hour are the authors of Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes, Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. One line is open if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Dave from Dubuque is next. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question about the title of the book, Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar. I wonder if there's a punchline to that. Is that a joke?
Okay.
Yes, it's a very bad joke.
Well, let's hear it.
We came up with the title before we came up with the punchline, which is always a bad. You're supposed to work backwards when you construct jokes, but there you are. So the punchline is that when Plato and his platypus walk into a bar, the bartender gives him a quizzical look. Is Plato a quizzical look? And Plato shrugs and says, "What can I tell you? She looked better in the cave."
Not our A material.
Thank you. Very good.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. How do you write jokes? You start. That's a hard thing to do, to write a joke, isn't it? Is your mind thinking of jokes frequently, Daniel?
Yeah, I haven't done it for a long time.
Really?
No, it was when I was a younger man I did it, and I worked for some very gifted people like Flip Wilson. And so it was, he made it easy. I mean, I would just sort of feed him stuff, and he would make up the jokes. The best material that I did wasn't really joke material. There was a guy I worked for a lot named David Fry. I don't know whether you're familiar.
Sure.
He was an impressionist, and he had Lyndon Johnson knocked.
Yes, I remember that now.
I mean, he was just this little guy, but he could make himself into this big Texan with the perfect draw and the timing of Lyndon Johnson. And so I would just sort of get into that head. I would listen to Johnson on the radio, and I would skew the things that Johnson was saying so that they were absurd. And I remember one line I came up with, you because Johnson was often doing his humble thing, and he'd say, "I'm just a simple Texas boy, you know, grew up barefoot and has now become your king."
Oh my! I was thinking about him so much last week when Lady Bird died, and two of them as a couple, what a match, huh?
Yeah.
I mean,
made in heaven, or possibly
I think he had a refining influence on him.
Yeah, right, yeah. Not much.
Not much.
And what about all the jokes in the book? Where have they come from?
All over the place.
Some
of them were jokes that we knew. Some of them were jokes that people told us when they knew we were doing the book.
Hmm.
Some of them are off the web. Some of them are out of joke books. Some of them are off the radio. We just picked up jokes wherever we possibly could.
Mm-hmm. And you know what part of the fun was? Discovering jokes that worked from cultures way different from ours.
Mm.
It turned out that Indians in East India have a whole bunch of jokes called Sardar jokes, and Sardars are, I hope this doesn't offend any of our Indian listeners, but they're kind of the blondes. Ooh, that's going to affect all our listeners. of India. And so there's the story about this detective, and he's training three Sardars to be detectives. And he says to them, "I'm going to flash you a picture of a suspect, and then you tell me what you can deduce from it." And so he flashes a picture of a suspect, and the first Sardar says, "Well, obviously the suspect has only one eye." And the inspector says, "No, don't be ridiculous. I just showed you a profile. That's why you only saw one eye." So he shows it to the second one, and the second one says, "Well, obviously the suspect only has one ear." And the guy says, "You made the same mistake, ridiculous. I showed you a profile. All you see is one ear." And he shows it to the third Sardar. And the Sardar says, "Obviously this suspect wears contact lenses." And the guy says, "Where's contact lenses?" And he goes back to his files and he looks up, and sure enough, the suspect wears contact lenses. And he comes back and he says, "That's quite amazing, Sardar. How did you come up with that?" And the Sardar says, "Well, he's only got one eye and one ear, so he couldn't wear regular glasses."
Oh, gee.
There are a lot of jokes about how we need to interpret our experience instead of just having it. You know, like the philosophy of empiricism, which is the philosophy that underlies science, is about getting information about the external world through our senses, but then you have to apply interpretation to it as well. You can't just sit there and soak up your sensory experience. You've got to interpret it on the basis of your past experience. So this guy goes to the doctor, and he says, "My wife, I think, has a very bad hearing problem." And the doctor says, "Well, there's a very simple test for that." He said, "When you go home tonight," he said, "just stand 10 feet behind her and ask her a question. And if she doesn't respond, move up to 5 feet behind her, ask her the question. If she still doesn't respond, go right up behind her, and ask her the question. So the guy goes home. His wife is at the stove cooking, and he stands in the kitchen door, and he says, honey, what are we having for dinner? No response. So he moves halfway into the kitchen, and he says, honey, what are we having for dinner? No response. So he moves right up behind her, and he says, honey, what are we having for dinner? And she says, for the third time, chicken.
Oh, that's good. All right, let's go to Chris is next from Green Bay. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
As a fellow major in philosophy, I'm kind of put off when I'm browsing the philosophy section, say Barnes & Noble, and I find philosophy of Buffy the Vampire Slayer and the philosophy of Seinfeld, and philosophy of Matrix, and things like that. And so with your book, I can also understand the desire to make things more appealing to the masses. So I'm kind of wondering where you draw the line between making it more palatable for the consumers versus cheapening philosophy itself.
Ooh.
Very good question.
Good question.
Very good question. And I'll give you an answer. I mean, our interest was in reaching a large audience. But the standard we set for ourselves, and I hope we followed, is that we did not want to become, and I hope I don't offend the dummies people, but we didn't want to become philosophy for dummies. Because there, you can simplify, as you well know, a philosophical concept so much to make it palatable or understandable that it then becomes wrong. And we just wouldn't do that. And so we had to omit some material that became too complex, like Tom was working very hard on Kant's table of antinomies, which is hard stuff to grasp. And we were trying to find jokes for it, which was difficult, too. But at some point we said, you know, in order to make this understandable, we're going to lose the tone of the book. And that became omitted from the book for that reason. Mm. So in a way, you're right. You know, you're not going to get a deep understanding of philosophy out of this. But I do think there's no bad information in the book, and it might whet a lot of people who, unlike you, didn't major in philosophy, it might whet their appetite to pick up the more complex texts.
Right.
We did a show, actually, in San Francisco called Philosophy Talk, and the two hosts of the show were the chair of the Stanford Philosophy Department and another member of the department. And we went in with a little fear and trembling, thinking, oh, my gosh, these guys are going to trash us. But, in fact, they didn't. They really got into it. They asked some excellent questions about the philosophy underlying. We must have given semi-adequate answers because they seemed happy with them.
They do a regular radio show called Philosophy Talk?
They do a philosophy
show.
No. NPR show.
It's on once a week on their NPR outlet.
Oh, my goodness. We'll have to talk to them.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, smart guys, real smart guys, and funny, too.
Yeah. I can't believe you apologize to the people who were dumb in the audience.
The guy who did the dummies book?
Yeah, really.
They're making a fortune. I have some respect for them.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Interestingly, we sent the manuscript to the publisher of those Philosophy of Seinfeld, Philosophy of the Sopranos, and they rejected it. So they must have seen that it was different in some way.
Right.
Maybe it was more true to philosophy, but they must have seen some difference.
Well, there's a lot of substance in it. You had a big task here to weave together all the jokes with all of the chapters, the logic, the ethics, because there's a lot of substance in the book as well. So so that's good, don't you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
I think so. I mean, we do admit to some omissions, but, you know, there's a lot of philosophy out there.
Right. And the book is not real big, so you need the second and the third.
And Roger, I'm very small myself.
Roger from Beaver Dam. Hi, Roger.
Hi. After the 2004 election, John Kerry was at his country club with his favorite horse, and they're coming up to an outdoor bar, and the bartender strikes up the conversation by saying, "Why the long faces?"
Yeah, that's a variation on an older joke. That's great.
Yeah, anyway, you related the experience with your father's death and needing to find closure, and to a large extent, I'm a farm boy, and I've delivered calves, and I've seen cows die, and animals die, and people die, and been to numbers of funerals and relatives, and had an experience a few years ago that sort of startled me. I kind of laughed at this closure idea. I thought, you know, that's a bunch of psychological hokum. But I had a very good friend who passed away and was cremated before the visitation thing. And then in our small town, it's kind of uncommon. It's getting more common now. And the thing that struck me was my internal reaction to the visitation without a body there, and just seeing the pictures on the placard and the remembrances of his life and things. It was almost like he didn't exist or had never existed, or it was the most disturbing feeling I've ever had at a memorial service. Without the body, it really confused me as to why I reacted that way. And I would be interested in hearing your comments.
All right, Thomas or Daniel, take it on. We only have about 10 seconds.
Okay, that's not very much time for a very serious answer, but yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
I can tell you a story. I don't know whether I have time for it. But
no, you don't. I'm sorry. Come back and we'll hear the story. Gentlemen,
but it's a great story.
I know. I'm glad they're there. Thank you so much for being with us. I really enjoyed the hour.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This was fun. This was a lot of fun. This done. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate you too as well. Thomas Cathcart, Daniel Klein. The book is Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks everybody for calling. So we'll be with you again tomorrow. This show repeats at 10 tonight. It's the kind of show you may want to tell somebody about. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.